Welcome to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Restaurants, says today's guest Saru Jeyaraman, are where American culture happens. Over 50% of Americans eat out at least once a week. But Jeyaraman goes on to say it's the people behind the kitchen door who make a restaurant. We interact with them daily, but few Americans know that the majority of these workers suffer under discriminatory labor practices and earn poverty-level wages, she says. The federal minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 an hour, and it's been that low for two decades. On top of that, wage theft, lack of sick days, health care, or overtime pay are issues that restaurant workers face all across the United States. And this workforce is 10 million strong. But if you're somebody who just eats at restaurants, you should be concerned, too, because this affects your health as well. Jeyaraman says, despite the surge of interest in organic, locally sourced, sustainable, healthy food, most Americans are totally unaware of the horribly exploitative working conditions in restaurants, which affect the quality of our food and ultimately our health. And she's doing something about it. Her new book is Behind the Kitchen Door. So can consumers and labor come together to fight for a more just workplace? That's the question we're going to tackle in this hour. Welcome, Saru. Are you there?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so you're local, but you're on a book tour and you're joining us from Boston.
I am, yes.
And we're also joined by Ung Chong, who's a restaurant worker and a board member of ROC United. Saru is the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunities Center, which is ROC. So welcome, Ung.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Hi. Thanks for being with us. So let me start with you, Saru. You got into this work because you were asked to help workers from Windows on the World, which is a restaurant that was destroyed in the World Trade Center attacks of 9/11. Tell us the story of what the workers there asked you to do and what was happening and how this affected your entire life and career.
Right. So on September 11th, there was a restaurant, as you said, at the top 107th floor of the World Trade Center Tower 1 called Windows on the World. That morning, about 73 workers died in the restaurant and about 250 workers lost their jobs. And about 13,000 restaurant workers lost their jobs in the months and weeks following the tragedy. And so I was asked by the union that was inside that restaurant, which was very small, very tiny, because less than 0.001% of all restaurant workers in the United States are unionized. I was asked by the union to help these workers as they didn't have the resources to help the workers. They were actually no longer members of the union because there was no restaurant and therefore no contract. And so we set up a relief organization essentially in the aftermath of the tragedy to help these workers who had lost their jobs and families of the victims. But we're pretty much almost instantly overwhelmed with cries for help from restaurant workers in general, first from all over New York City and then from all over the country and now actually even from other parts of the world, saying, you know, there's been no voice for us. There's been no place for us. And we quickly found out why we were being so overwhelmed. As you mentioned, the restaurant industry right now is neck and neck with retail as the largest and fastest growing sector of the U.S. economy with over 10 million workers. It's actually one in 10 Americans. And so when you've got the largest and fastest growing sector of the economy proliferating literally the lowest paying jobs, because 7 of the 11 lowest paying jobs in America and the 2 absolute lowest paying jobs in America are restaurant jobs, lower than farm workers, lower than every other occupation you might think of as a low paying job. Restaurant workers are literally at the bottom.
What are the two lowest paying jobs?
They are actually dishwashers in all different kinds of restaurants, from fast food to fine dining, and fast food preps and cooks. Those are the two lowest paid workers in America. Although, believe it or not, servers, the median wage for servers is only about 30 cents more than it is for dishwashers and fast food preps and cooks. And so,
30 cents more on average.
About on average. So, you know, you've literally got the largest and fastest growing industry proliferating the lowest paying jobs. And it is not because it's inherent to the nature of restaurants that they have to pay people very little. You know, the industry cries about low profit margins when, in fact, across the board, this industry has 4 to 5 times the profit margin of Walmart, which is generally considered to be a pretty profitable company. So it's a the real reason why you've got the largest and fastest growing industry with the lowest wages is because of the power of this incredible industry lobby called the National Restaurant Association, which we call the other NRA, which is responsible for literally pouring millions of dollars into Congress members' hands to keep the minimum wage for all workers at the federal level at $7.25, and for keeping the minimum wage for tipped workers in particular at $2.13 an hour. In fact, this is due to a deal that the NRA, under the leadership of Herman Cain, former nominee for the Republican ticket for president, when he was the head of the NRA, struck a deal with Congress saying that they would not oppose a modest increase to the overall minimum wage as long as the minimum wage for tipped workers stayed frozen forever. And so it's been stuck at $2.13 an hour for the last 22 years. And so essentially after 9/11, we were coming on the scene, being overwhelmed with cries for help, starting to understand why this was happening, what was really going on in this industry. And so we realized pretty early on that we couldn't just do one thing to build power and voice for workers. And so we built a multi-pronged strategy that essentially has meant definitely organizing, mobilizing, and lifting the voices of thousands of workers. We now have 10,000 restaurant worker members in 26 cities, but it's also meant partnering with employers that are doing it right. We have about 100 employer partners around the country that show that you can do it right, provide good wages and good working conditions, and several thousand consumer members as well. And this has been our strategy, is to bring together all three stakeholders, workers, employers, and consumers, to say that, you know, we're all impacted by the way workers are treated in this industry. And when restaurant workers are treated well and treated better, actually employers do better and consumers definitely have a healthier and better dining experience as well.
And that's Saru Jayaraman, and she's the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, that's ROC. And she's also director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California, Berkeley, here locally. And her new book is Behind the Kitchen Door, which makes the case for improving the rights of restaurant workers nationwide. So obviously you're trying to change the profile of this and make it higher profile, but why is it that this is such an invisible issue when, as you say, 50% of Americans eat out at least once a week? We're talking about 10 million workers here. And you also write that people are becoming really hip to organic, ecological, sustainable food, slow food. Why do you think it is that we haven't transferred that kind of care or consumer demand to the fair treatment of restaurant workers?
I think a lot of it is just simply lack of access to information. Most people do not know what is happening behind the kitchen door, hence the title of my book. And I argue that it is purposeful. The National Restaurant Association does not want most Americans to know that the minimum wage for tipped workers is $2.13 an hour. And, you know, when I'm on talk shows with them, you know, sitting alongside the National Restaurant Association or a representative, they'll say things like, oh, well, nobody's actually earning the tip minimum wage of $2.13 anywhere in the country. These are workers who earn lots and lots of money in tips, when in fact 70% of workers who earn that tip minimum wage of $2.13 an hour are women. And in the vast majority, they work in the IHOP and Applebee's and Olive Garden, Red Lobster, and they earn poverty wages. In fact, servers in America suffer from three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. So a terrible irony, the people who put food on our tables cannot afford to eat themselves. And so one example in my book is the story of a young woman named Claudia Munoz, who was a restaurant worker in Houston, Texas, earning $2.13 an hour. She was working at an IHOP, and the law says that any employer is supposed to make sure that tips make up the difference between the minimum wage of $2.13 and the regular minimum wage of $7.25. But the IHOP told her, you know, mega corporation that they are, and even though it's illegal, they told her, we're not going to be held liable to pay the difference. So we're going to report that you're earning $7.25 regardless of what you earn. And many days went by, slow days, slow shifts, graveyard shifts, where Claudia didn't earn almost anything at all in tips and struggled to eat, put food on the table. She said she was really hungry. She would wait to get to the restaurant to eat pancakes, and some days she would flirt with the cooks to get more food. She was starving, actually. And one night she worked a full night shift in the restaurant, and a couple walked out at the end of the night without paying the bill. And the restaurant, illegal though it is, and even though IHOP's a mega corporation, asked her to pay for that bill. And so she ended up paying $20 for the luxury of having worked a graveyard shift, a full night shift at the IHOP. And we hear these stories over and over and over again. And they're the kinds of stories the National Restaurant Association doesn't want America to hear. As long as America thinks these workers are fine, they're paid okay, that the tip is actually on top of a wage, not the wage itself, we're not going to advocate or fight that the wage be raised, and they can continue to get away with not actually paying their own workers' wages, but having customers pay their workers' wages for them. So it's definitely purposeful that people don't know about it. And I think the reason why people do know about local and organic and free-range chicken is because they were recently educated about it. You know, people read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, and Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma. They maybe saw the movie Food, Inc. There's been a lot of very generalized talk among masses of people about local and organic. It's become common knowledge. And so that's what we're trying to do with this book, Behind the Kitchen Door. Eric Schlosser, who wrote Fast Food Nation, has written the foreword. And Eric has said on many occasions that this actually is the key issue that the food movement needs to deal with at this moment, the most urgent, the most important. Because for people who care anything about their health or care about locally sourced food or organic, if you care about your health, it's not enough to know how the pigs and the chickens and the produce was treated. You really need to know that the workers who are touching your food are not too poor or too sick to take care of themselves if you really care about your health. And so it's just been a matter of letting people know. And I have to say, as we go around the country and let people know about this issue, I have not encountered a single person who is not outraged by the fact that the tip minimum wage has been stuck at 213, outraged by the fact that 90% of these workers don't have paid sick days, and outraged by the fact that they didn't know these things because they've been purposefully held from them.
And that's Saru Jeyaraman, who's co-founder of Restaurant Opportunities Center, and she's the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. And let me invite our listeners to actually join us. 866-798-TALK is the toll-free number, 866-798-8255. You can also send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you eat out regularly or even occasionally, what do you notice about the people who work in restaurants? And would you sign on to a social justice campaign that asks diners to become more active about labor conditions? 866-798-TALK. That's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. And if you work in a restaurant or have worked in one, were you in front of or behind the kitchen door? What did you notice about your working conditions, and especially those of the people behind the kitchen door? What do you love about your job, and what might you change? And does today's guest make you want to organize? Again, that number is 866-798-TALK, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And we have, you were just talking about the low wages. I think in one of your interviews, you said that some restaurant workers get a check that says this is not a paycheck because their $2.13 an hour all goes to the IRS to cover taxes on the wages that either they are supposed to get or are getting through tips. And a caller who couldn't stay on said he wanted clarification on a statistic that you gave out and we gave out. Did you say that restaurant workers are 10% of the workforce?
So the National Restaurant Association, that's right, 1 in 10 American workers. You know, it depends on how you calculate. It goes between 1 in 10. The New York Times says it's 1 in 13, but it's very close to 1 in 10.
So the caller says, does that mean that there are only 100 million people working in the U.S.?
You're looking at working adults, right? Looking at people who are eligible to work and working adults, yes.
Gotcha. And let me also invite Ung Chang, who's a restaurant worker and an ROC worker member representative on the board of ROC, and he's joining us now. Hi, Ung.
Hey, how are you, Holly?
So how'd you get involved in organizing for restaurant workers' rights, and tell us about what you do right now.
My name is Ung Chang, and I am a restaurant worker now. I currently work full-time as a bartender here in Washington, D.C. I'm actually originally from the Bay Area, but I've moved up to D.C. about 3.5 years ago. And I got into the industry about 9 years ago, left for a few years, but I've been in the industry doing beverage for the last 6 years or so at every level, from the bartender to a barback to a management to a short stint as a prep cook as well in the back of the kitchen.
So and what do you make
for a while?
What do you make an hour?
Now I actually make $8.20 an hour.
What about with tips? You're a bartender, right?
I am a bartender, yes.
So with tips?
With tips and everything included, my hourly wage comes out to about just over $20 an hour.
Right. So for both of you, I think that that's the common perception for a lot of people who are eating out and leaving 20% is that, you know, some of these workers are well paid.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah, that is.
And a lot of times you hear this, bartenders, and you guys make a lot of money, and why is this an issue? But the truth is, the situation that I'm in now, it's not the norm. It's the exception to the rule. In fact, the majority of people I've worked with, and all the way up until this job that I have now, I have not made as much as I have now. So the misconception that the bartenders, these are the young people, college graduates who are making good money and they're just waiting for a bigger and better things, is just not true at all.
Well, can I ask you guys both about discrimination, the equation around ethnicity, immigrant workers, and promotion? I think that, Ung, you talk about this, the fact that you're an immigrant, but you went to school here, you speak English, and so you were able to get promoted. But, Saru, in your book, you really write about this being a real issue, in that there's major ethnic discrimination in restaurants.
Yeah. So let me clarify something just based on what you said earlier. So Ung works in Washington, D.C., and the tip minimum wage there is $2.77 an hour. And so Ung is an exception. But, you know, if you live in a San Francisco or Washington, D.C., and you think, oh, you know, servers are these really well-tipped steakhouse, you know, fine dining restaurant workers, they're doing just fine. What you don't realize is that in most of America, as I mentioned before, 70% of servers are women working at the IHOP, Applebee's, Olive Garden, Denny's, working graveyard shifts. And that is why you see a median wage nationwide of $8.81 for servers, and why servers, you know, you look at government data, servers have three times the poverty rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce and use food stamps at double the rate of the rest of the U.S. workforce. So most servers in America are not. Ooh, they are women working late night shifts at the Denny's. And I'm sure many of your readers read Barbara Ehrenreich's Nickel and Dimed. You may remember the section of her book where she was a waitress in a diner and really struggling to pay the rent. I think she even lived in her car during that time because tips simply did not bring her to a sustainable level of living. And that's seen because the median wage is $8.81, including tips. So let's be clear about who these folks are. When we talk about segregation and discrimination and workers of color not able to move up the ladder, we're talking about not able to move up the ladder to fine dining waitstaff and bartending positions, which is very different from where most servers and bartenders in America work. Most servers and bartenders in America don't work in fine dining. But in a fine dining restaurant, you'll find the only livable wage jobs for workers in this industry, the only livable wage non-management jobs, which are fine dining server and bartender positions. And moving up the ladder to those jobs is not, in fact, it is not a matter of language. It is not a matter of immigration status. It is, in fact, a matter of skin color and skin color alone. And how do we know this? We know because we sent 200 pairs of white and people of color applicants into fine dining restaurants, the people of color having a better resume, no accent whatsoever. And we found that white applicants had twice the chance of a person of color of getting one of these jobs. And so then to the notion that it's because these people have accents or they don't speak English, we gave some testers, very white testers, very strong European accents, and we gave the people of color third world accents. And we found that having a European accent, even when it was strong, was actually a bonus in getting a job. Whereas having a third world accent of any kind, even slight, was a detractor. And so we know it's not actually about language ability. It's not actually about immigration status. It is actually about race. It is about race because there are plenty of people out there who do speak English very well, know the menu, know the wine, you know, have been bussers and workers in what we call the back of the house for a very long time, but have not been able to advance to these livable wage, fine dining and wait staff and bartending positions in fine dining restaurants.
Which can pay a livable wage or even a good wage. That's Saru Jayaraman, who's co-founder of Restaurant Opportunities Center United, and she's also the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. We're also joined by Ung Chang, who's a restaurant worker and an ROC worker member representative on the board of directors. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and let's go to our callers. Jim in South Bend, Indiana. Welcome to your call.
Thank you. I had a question. I grew up and was a busser, was my first job in high school. And so I know that servers don't make a lot of money. And so the way I combat that is I tend to tip well, because I think anybody who used to work in a restaurant tends to do that. And what I wonder is, do you think that we should basically go to a European model where we don't tip as well, but the restaurants are required to pay better?
With benefits. Let's have Saru answer that.
Yeah, so thank you so much for the question. It's a really great question because when I'm talking, people often think, oh, you know, we just should tip better and that will help these workers and that will be the solution. The problem with that is that that means we continue to subsidize an industry that requires us to pay its workers' wages for it, right?
Right.
And there are actually 7 states in the United States that don't have this system, in the U.S., not even in Europe. And they include actually California, Washington, Oregon, Nevada, Montana, Alaska, and Minnesota, all of which are doing quite well. The industry in those states are doing quite well. In fact, 5 of those 7 states have faster growing growth rates in their restaurant industries than most of the other states in the United States.
Can I just clarify something? So what you're saying is that California has a statewide minimum wage, including for tipped workers, and in San Francisco it's $10.25, but people are still tipped.
People are still tipped. And so there's a base wage that allows people some stability in their lives, right? Some stability, because tips go up and down, but your rent doesn't go up and down. Your bills don't go up and down, even if you're a fine dining server. There's a story in my book of a young white man in Michigan and working at a fine dining restaurant, earning $2.65, which is the Michigan state tip minimum wage. And some days he got tips and others he didn't. And he couldn't even afford to pay the gas to get to work. And so, you know, tips fluctuate. And so in these 7 states, workers have a base wage, you know, a base minimum wage that's the same as everybody else. And then tips are on top of that. And so to answer the question, it's not that we are saying that actually at the federal level, right this moment, the bill that we are fighting for is called the Fair Minimum Wage Act of 2013, introduced by Congressman Miller in the House and Senator Harkin in the Senate. And it proposes raising the overall minimum wage to $10.10 an hour, because we can't forget about those dishwashers and cooks who are not tipped, who definitely need a raise, who are the poorest workers in America and need a raise, fast food workers who need a raise. But it also would bring the tipped minimum wage to 70% of that, or $7. And so that there's some kind of base, stable wage that allows workers some amount of stability, and then tips can be on top of that. So it's not that at the moment we're proposing even going as far as California has gone, or these other 7 states in the United States. We're simply saying, let's bring the tip minimum wage up to a level that allows people some amount of base wage with economic stability and security.
And thank you. Sorry, you're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan, and we'll be right back after this short break.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco. To join today's conversation, the number to call is 866-798-8255, 866-798-TALK. If you'd prefer to write rather than call, the email inbox address is feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're supported in part here at Local Public Radio by An Evening with David Sedaris. This Sunday, May the 5th, at San Francisco's War Memorial Opera House, David will be joining us for an evening of all new readings and recollections. Tickets and information at davidsedarisontour.com.
For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan. For those of you joining us now, I'm Holly Kernan, and this is Your Call. We're podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also listen to past shows there and find out what's coming up next. Tomorrow, we'll ask, what do you want from Your Call? We'll open the lines and hear your ideas and feedback about the show. Friday is our media weekly roundtable where we speak with journalists about coverage of the week's news. And today, what is the reality for restaurant workers? We're talking with Saru Jayaraman about her new book, Behind the Kitchen Door. She writes that despite the surge of interest in sustainable, healthy food, most Americans are totally unaware of the horribly exploitative working conditions in restaurants. So what's your relationship to restaurant workers? Are you one of them? How can we improve restaurants on both sides of the kitchen door? And if you're a restaurant owner or manager, we'd also like to hear your perspective on this issue. Does it help to treat your workers well? 866-798-8255 is the toll-free number, 866-798-TALK, or you can send us an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also leave comments at our website, which is yourcallradio.org, where there's all of the information about today's show there. And Saru, I'm so sorry, we were going to a hard break and I cut you off just a little bit. We were talking about this system of tipping, and I was just wondering, why do we have this tipping system and culture in the U.S.? One of the things that you write about in your book is that the relationship of people in the U.S. with restaurants and eating out is very different than in other cultures.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely statistically eat out more than anybody else on earth. And we also actually celebrate our most intimate, wonderful moments in restaurants, birthdays, anniversaries, weddings, proposals. It's
you
a
met your husband in a restaurant, right?
I did. Yeah. I met my husband in a restaurant. I think most people can remember a wonderful moment in a restaurant, and it's a wonderful thing. We celebrate American culture in restaurants, and yet we know so very little about the people who are touching and serving our food, which I find really striking, given the fact that if you think about eating at home, somebody touching, serving, cooking your food is typically somebody you care a lot about or somebody who cares about you. And so why is it that we don't know more about the people who are touching our food? I would argue that it's pretty purposeful. I don't think that the general American public really doesn't want to know anything about the people touching our food. I don't think that most Americans, and I know this to be true given all the, you know, touring I've been doing around the country, I don't think most Americans even know that their tip is not something on top of a wage, but it is the wage itself.
Go ahead. Finish your thought, and then I got a question.
I don't think most Americans know the pervasive problems of the lack of paid sick days, the fact that 90% of these workers don't have paid sick days, which means that 2/3 report cooking, preparing, and serving food when they're sick. And Oon can tell you a really amazing story about that.
I don't think most Americans
know these things. And it's not that Americans don't want to know. It's not that Americans want to eat out and be blind to these things. I do think there is a kind of a purposeful separation between the fact that these things exist and our dining experience.
So I want to get to the health question in just a sec. But before that, can you break it down for us about how a restaurant works, and particularly tips? If you leave a $10 tip on the table, who's going to get that? Is it divided up? And what are kind of the hierarchy in the restaurant?
Well, first of all, we recently passed a bill in the city of Philadelphia making it illegal to deduct credit card processing fees from workers' tips, which is legal mostly everywhere else, which means that first we recommend that you leave your tips in cash rather than on a credit card. But even when you do, that tip is shared by numerous workers, the server, the bussers, often the runners, the bartender. Sometimes it's shared with the host. That's not always completely illegal. Often it's shared with management, which is definitely not legal. We find that 1 in 5 workers reports that their tips are taken by management, which is completely illegal. And so that tip is shared by numerous people, but it also is for most workers in America, it is their wage. It is almost entirely their wage because, as you said, when you get a wage as low as $213, it goes entirely to taxes, and so you are completely reliant on tips for your wages, right? And I do want to point out, Holly, that this is actually not the way it has to be. We've got about 100 employer partners around the country. They range from celebrity chefs like Tom Colicchio, who's the star of Top Chef and actually a really great employer, all the way down to small mom-and-pop restaurants that are trying to do the right thing, provide good wages and good working conditions. And they have been able to prove that actually many of them provide higher wages than the tipped minimum wage or the regular minimum wage. And they feel that they do better because they treat their workers better, not in spite of it. So one example is Curry Blossom Cafe in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, which pays $10 an hour to all starting workers, regardless of whether they earn tips or not. It's $10 for tipped workers plus tips. And they are wildly successful. They have 30 employees. They're growing. They just joined us and a group of other employers from around the country to announce an alternative National Restaurant Association. They came with us to Congress and they said, you know what? The National Restaurant Association doesn't speak for us. That's big business. We are small business restaurant owners and we see that taking the high road to profitability, providing good wages and better working conditions actually results in lower turnover among employees, higher profitability, higher productivity, all of these things. And they're actually doing well because of it. So I think as the public gets to know that there are employers out there doing the right thing and starts showing their support, I think it will be more and more the case that consumer demand for these things will change the industry itself.
And you're listening to Your Call. That's Saru Jayaraman. She's co-founder of Restaurant Opportunity Centers United and the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. We're also joined by Ung Chang, who's a restaurant worker and a board member of ROC. I want to get to more of our callers. But one of the things that you write about is if you don't care about the working conditions of these people, this huge workforce, it is a public health issue that you should care about. And Ung, you actually had a really serious illness and you were required to work. Can you just tell us about that? And then, Saru, maybe you can quickly talk about the health issues here and then we can get to more callers. Go ahead, Ung. Did we lose? We lost Ung. All right, so go ahead. And Saru, can you tell us? We'll get him back on the line. He had H1N1. He had swine flu and was forced to work. And you tell a lot of these stories in your book. And part of it is that most restaurant workers do not get paid sick leave. So talk to us about
this. That's right. So, again, this is an issue that the National Restaurant Association and many corporations have been fighting against, having to provide paid sick days to their workers. So one example is, in fact, Darden. Darden is the world's largest full-service restaurant company. They own Olive Garden, Red Lobster, Capital Grille Steakhouse, Longhorn Steakhouse, and a number of other brands. They're the world's largest full-service company. And back at the end of 2011, they announced a partnership with Michelle Obama's Let's Move campaign, saying that they were going to provide healthy food for kids at the Olive Garden. Well, the exact same moment that announcement was made, a server in a Fayetteville, North Carolina Olive Garden was forced to work with hepatitis A because the Olive Garden does not provide paid sick days. And 3,000 people had to get tested for hepatitis A, filed a consumer class action against the restaurant, and won. And that same year, there were two outbreaks of norovirus. And if you don't know what norovirus is, you really don't want to know. It's called the winter vomiting bug. There were two norovirus outbreaks at Olive Gardens in Illinois. And so we ask, really, how healthy can the food be for kids when workers are forced to go to work when sick? The CDC, the Center for Disease Control, reports that 50 to 90% of all norovirus outbreaks can be traced back to sick restaurant workers. And this is not because restaurant workers want to go to sick and get your food sick. You know, they don't want to get you sick. They don't want to get their coworkers sick. But the reality is many times restaurant workers are told that if they don't go to work, even when they're sick, they will be fired. And even if they're not told that, if you live off of your tips, you have no choice but to actually go to work to get those tips, even when you're sick. And we've heard this over and over and over again, workers having to work work when they're sick, infecting coworkers, infecting customers, and honestly having to choose between their health and the health of everybody around them and their job. In fact, we interviewed an employer in New York City who actually said to us, you know, it's kind of a joke. We, the restaurant industry, everybody knows in our industry, we, the restaurant industry in New York, single-handedly promulgate the flu during the winter season because everybody knows everybody works when they're sick in the restaurant industry.
That's Saru Jayaraman. She's co-founder of Restaurant Opportunity Center United, and she's also director of the Food Labor Research Center at UC Berkeley. She's the author of Behind the Kitchen Door. You're listening to Your Call. I'm Holly Kernan. Today is May 1st, International Workers' Day, and we're considering the working conditions of those who cook and serve our food in restaurants. It's an industry with 10 million workers, and 50% of Americans say they eat out at least once a week. So we're talking about what that means for our health and our economy and our society. And we have lots of callers on the line. I want to get to them. Justin in San Francisco, welcome to your call.
Hey, thank you. It's interesting. I was at Chipotle last night, kind of seeing, I was there late at night, 8 o'clock, and just saw the vacant look on the employees' eyes and kind of just see this, it's basically fast food reworked. It looks a little different, organic rice, all that. And it made me reflect that I worked there 12 years ago, and I was just there for a kind of a summer job, and realized that the manager was actually stealing our tips, that they were disappearing out of the box. And I didn't need the job, but all the employees around me, mostly Latino employees, needed that work. And so I was willing to kind of alienate myself and go to the district manager and complain about our tips being stolen, and nothing happened, you know. And so it's interesting to kind of see to see this reworking and these new wave restaurants that are happening. And I was just reading an article about Michael Pollan saying that Chipotle is his favorite restaurant. So I'm interested to hear about what you think about these new wave restaurants and how that plays into this whole dialogue.
And how you're getting them to dialogue with you to sort of change this equation, Saru.
Yeah, it's a great question, because I think there's an assumption out there that if people embrace sustainability in terms of organic and local and free-range chicken, that they automatically embrace, as an employer, sustainable working conditions. And this has been our fight, to say sustainability has to include sustainable working conditions for the people touching your food. If you care about local, if you care about organic, if you care about your health, sadly right now, it is not the case. The vast majority of restaurants out there that embrace local and organic, which is a lot of them, because Michael Pollan himself has help make this a trend, they don't embrace sustainable working conditions. You can see that in the data, the fact that there are far more restaurants out there embracing local and organic than pay livable wages or provide paid sick days. And so there is so much that we can do as consumers to change this, because let me tell you something, that local, organic, even Chipotle, that didn't happen overnight. That did not happen organically, no pun intended. That did not happen simply because those restaurants woke up one day and said, we're going to provide locally sourced organic food. It happened because people read Michael Pollan's book, Omnivore's Dilemma. People read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, saw Food Inc., and asked every time they ate out, is this locally sourced? Is this organic? Is this free-range chicken? Demanded those things. And restaurants responded to that demand. And so we believe the same kind of consumer demand around issues of livable wages and paid sick days could result in real change in our industry. And so we're asking everybody out there, consumers, three ways that we can all act to change this. The first is to educate yourself, to please get the book Behind the Kitchen Door, learn what's happening. It's a metaphor. It's not really just about workers behind the kitchen door. It's about all of the things that we don't know that are happening in restaurants. Educate yourself. Please get the word out. Let people know, in the same way that lots of people read Michael Pollan's book and Eric Schlosser's books. We need people to know this information and to get the book out there. That's number one. Number two is to please join us in letting Congress know enough is enough. Stop listening to the mega fast food and corporations like Darden, Olive Garden. Please listen to the people who eat out. Listen to workers. Listen to your actual constituents and raise that minimum wage for tipped workers and non-tipped workers. So we have a website where you can actually go sign a petition called thewelcometable.net.
All of that information, Saru, all of that information is at yourcallradio.org. Just so we can keep it lean. Go on. Yeah. What's number three?
Well, number three is instead of, as we talked about earlier, instead of just thinking, gosh, listening to her, I really should just tip better, we're asking you not just to tip better, you should tip well, but please to speak up every time you eat out. So we've actually created a national diner's guide to let you know how restaurants around you are faring on these issues. You can download it for free on your smartphone, and you can use it to speak up every time you eat out, anywhere you eat out, at the same way you might have asked 10 years ago or 5 years ago, is this locally sourced, is this organic, what's in my food, is this vegetarian? At the end of your meal, to go up to the manager and say, love the food, love the service. I would love to see you provide paid sick days, or I'd love to see you provide a livable wage to your workers. I want to keep coming here, and I want you to know those things are important to me as a consumer. We really believe, in the same way that those questions changed the industry, made Chipotle provide locally sourced, fresh, organic food, in those same ways we could get Chipotle to provide paid sick days and a livable wage to their workers.
And so let's have more consumers join us. We're at 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free number. How can we facilitate a conversation between restaurant goers and restaurant workers? If you are somebody who eats out, would you sign on to this social justice campaign that asks diners to become more active about labor conditions? Have you considered some of these experiences as you're making your dining choices? 866-798-8255. We also really want to invite anybody who's a manager at a restaurant or a restaurant owner. What's your perspective on this, and what's the equation, that the calculations that you make in your own mind about these issues and what you pay your workers and how you treat them? And if you're somebody who works in the industry, we definitely want to hear from you. The number again is 866-798-8255. Talk. It's a toll-free number, 866-798-8255. Let us know what you think about all of this and what your own experience is and how we change the conversation about this. Let's go to Lark in San Francisco. Hi, Lark. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thank you. Love your show and love eating out. Three quick things. My first is, it's my feeling that people, whether it's going to restaurants or staying in a hotel or what have you, they don't really... whether they don't care, whether they don't want to know, or whether it just doesn't cross their mind, kind of want to know about all the people who make that situation a wonderful one. When you stay in a hotel, all the people who clean the rooms and so on and so forth. And I remember a number of years ago when there was a janitorial strike in the South Bay, and the pictures were very ironic because it was these very high-end workers going to work in the valley, crossing the picket line, of these, you know, people who were cleaning out their, you know, facilities. I don't know if that rings a bell for you.
So you're making a parallel between hotel workers, hospitality workers, and restaurant workers.
Right. In other words, people don't kind of want to, you know, we should all think more about all the particular, you know, that make the experience. It's a wonderful one.
Well, let me throw that then to Ung, actually, who works in this business and has for over a decade, right, Ung?
Yeah.
So yeah, tell us about this idea that Lark is bringing up, this idea that there's an invisibility, that maybe people don't even want to see the people behind the kitchen door or the hotel door.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times, like Sarah mentioned, we celebrate these most intimate moments of in our lives, but a lot of times, when you think about these moments, you could probably never guess who served your food or who cooked your food and who brought the food to your table. And don't think it's necessarily I think it's always by design, really, that it's not only the industry itself, we're just kind of made to be almost of an invisible hand that people don't have to worry about. They all just think they're just automatically taken care of. But then that's not necessarily true at all. These are the everyday folks that actually work Like I mentioned earlier, it's not just the college folks who are just making society. The majority of the folks who work in this industry are the people with families and women that have with children that actually support themselves and actually take a great pride and passion in what they do. What we're just trying to do is just make us a little more visible, make us to come out of this behind the kitchen, so to speak.
Yeah, and one of the things that Saru writes about a lot is just this love of the work that people are in this industry are really dedicated to it and frequently feel very, very passionate, as you just spoke of, about it. So it's not this victimhood that you're talking about. It's about fairness and justice, but that people really want to be in this industry. Or some people.
Exactly. I'm a college graduate with a degree, and I chose to go into this field because I was passionate about food and beverage. And I stayed in this field for the past 9 years just because it was my passion and just what I wanted to do with my life. And then you meet these folks, these colleagues that I've been so fortunate to work with that are fueled by their passion and their pride in this industry and what they do. It's not just a job. It's a profession. And it's not only a profession, but it's a profession of passion and a pride for them.
Oh, let me try and get some more callers in. Let's go to Larry in San Francisco. Hi, Larry. Welcome to your call.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. And I wanted to say that the challenge we face is ubiquitous through the food industry. Most producers don't want people to know where their food comes from, what's in it, how it's made. You know, the most, let alone the workers involved. I mean, certainly the most egregious things are finding horse meat in your meatballs that are supposed to be beef, buying orange juice that is essentially oranges harvested by slave labor. There's no other word to use it. And so I'm involved in a project that's just emerging. It's called Square Plate. And we've developed a certification program for restaurants and catering services to look at not just where the food comes from and its sustainability as far as local, organic, how it's grown, and not just about the nutrition elements, which are equally important and often disguised.
Larry, I'm really sorry. We so want to hear about it. It's called Square Plate. We'll put a link to that at yourcallradio.org, but your line is so bad that we can't hear you. Saru, I'm going to let you respond to Larry. So the idea here is that there are a lot of these movements cropping up and that it sounds like you've got your finger on the pulse of something that may be the next issue. I'm wondering, a lot of people today are marching for immigration reform. It's May 1st. And I'm wondering what the connection between the issues that you're writing about in Behind the Kitchen Door and these larger issues of immigration reform are, because you write that 40% of New York City restaurant workers are undocumented immigrants. Is that a real factor in trying to organize around this?
So it is a real factor in cities like New York and definitely San Francisco, L.A., Chicago, Miami, definitely where there are large numbers of immigrants in this industry. It's actually something that we in the National Restaurant Association agree on, that these workers need to stay in this country for this industry to survive. And they just should stay in this country because they've been here working very hard. They should have a path to legalization. Where we don't agree is how, under what conditions they stay. And so the National Restaurant Association is very much in favor of something called E-Verify, which would require all restaurant companies, small businesses, and large alike, basically to spend about $25,000 on technology that would require them to basically act as immigration agents, checking the status of every single employee that walks in the door. And this, unfortunately, is on the table as part of the current bill that's being looked at in Congress. The small businesses that we've worked with say this would kill them. It is not their job to act as an immigration agent. Yes, they take documents, and that should be all they're asked to do, not to go and check by a government database, which has been proved to be more than 51% inaccurate, actually, to hire or fire workers. So these are the kinds of things that the National Restaurant Association is proposing. They want an immigration reform that keeps immigrant workers without the ability to speak up on the job, without the ability to actually organize, tied to a particular employer so they're not able to change jobs. All of these things would keep basically the same kind of underclass that we've got right now with immigrant workers unable to speak up, and in some ways creating a perverse incentive for employers to desire workers who are basically unable to speak up at all about wages or working conditions.
I want to get to a final question. We have only 2 minutes left, and you talk in your book about, I can imagine a day when millions of consumers across the United States advocate for restaurant workers in very small ways. We literally only have 90 seconds for you to speak here. Can you just give specific examples of what you mean when you say, when you go to a restaurant, speak out?
But you go to a restaurant the next time, at the end of your meal, go up to the manager, not the workers, the manager or the owner, and say, love the food, love the service, just wanted you to know, providing livable wages and paid sick days is important to me as a consumer. Providing pathways for people to move up the ladder without basis of race or gender is really important to me as a consumer. I'd like to see your company do that.
All right. And, Ung, do you have one final thought on what consumers who are listening can do?
It goes back to what you guys have been talking about, which is, as long as consumers, we have immense power as consumers, what you can do. So when you demand our industry is resilient, we will respond, and that's a promise. So by all means, please go out every time you please demand these things.
All right. Well, thanks to both of you for joining us. We were joined by Saru Jayaraman, who's the co-founder and co-director of the Restaurant Opportunity Center United. She's also director of the Food Labor Research Center at the University of California. And her new book, Behind the Kitchen Door, makes the case for improving the rights of restaurant workers nationwide. We'll put all of that information at yourcallradio.org. And you can find links to what you can do as a consumer, along with all this information. We've also been joined by Ung Chang, who's a restaurant worker and a board member of ROC United. He works as head bartender in a fine dining restaurant in Washington, D.C., and he's been in the industry for about 10 years. Thanks to both of you for joining us. I thank all of the people who called and emailed. I apologize that we couldn't get to all of your calls. There's more. You can continue the conversation by posting comments at yourcallradio.org, including what you're doing about this and any innovative projects that you know of. Thanks to everybody. I'm Holly Kernan, and you're listening to Your Call. What do you want from Your Call? We're opening the phones to get your feedback on the show. In your mind, what are the values of the program? If you were writing our mission statement, what would you include? Are there specific shows that have stood out to you in some way? How can we best focus on solutions to the challenging issues of our times? Join us at 10 or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What makes you listen to Your Call? It truly is Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco, with special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz.